Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, we scrutinise the United States' Pacific Pledge, find out more about a monster-sized tourism development in Vanuatu, and we hear from Marshall Islands, the little mouse that roared and won a seat on the UN Human Rights Council. First, though, while Australia continues with its Pacific step-up, the United States is ramping up its presence in the region with its Pacific Pledge. The US State Department's Deputy Director for the Office of Australia, New Zealand and Pacific Affairs, Jennifer Spandy, characterises the pledge as Washington's way to step up its partnership efforts in the region. And Ms. Spandy concedes that Chinese activity in the Pacific is certainly on American minds, but she says the pledge is underpinned by tens of millions of dollars in extra funding.
Pledge is the U.S. commitment to the Pacific Islands, and it's part of a broader American strategy called the Indo-Pacific Strategy. So when the U.S. looks at the Indo-Pacific as a region, we're deeply committed to keeping it free and open and to ensuring that every country can make its own decisions and that there's an environment where countries play by the rules and operate transparently. So that's something that we work with allies on across the entire Indo-Pacific region. When we look specifically at the Pacific Islands, we know that a lot of Pacific Island nations face obstacles to their economic development. A lot of them are small, many are very distant from major markets, and many have limited natural resources. And so because we're a top donor to the Pacific and because we recognize the particular challenges that Pacific Islands face, we know that development assistance is a particularly important part of our engagement. So the Pacific Pledge is really a way to step up our efforts to partner with the Pacific Islands so that we can help meet their most pressing economic and development security challenges.
To pick up on that point then, in terms of funding for the Pacific Island nations, is there a figure in terms of what the U.S. intends to invest, and how does Washington envisage that money being spent?
We have been spending $350 million every year in the Pacific. So on top of that, this year, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced an additional $100 million in new funding. And that's going to be spent in a variety of different areas. Some of the biggest items are promoting sound, just, and responsive governments. We want to help empower citizens, help them combat corruption, and help strengthen the autonomy of national governments. We're also working to help train local journalists and provide better access to credible news sources, to expand digital connectivity, to help address some natural disaster challenges, because we know those are really particularly severe in the Pacific, or Pacific Island nations can be especially vulnerable. And then when we look at security issues, we have funding that's going to go to help stop illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, to help specifically in the freely associated states with some of their security challenges, and to embed some security advisors. And then the last big chunk of funding under the Pacific Pledge is $23 million, which is funding that's going to help start fulfill the U.S. pledge that Vice President Pence made with leaders from Australia, New Zealand, and Japan to help boost the electrification rate in Papua New Guinea from 13% to 70%.
Can I pick up on that question of the security advisors and the embedding, as I understand it, in three countries, Fiji, Palau, and also Solomon Islands? Clearly, people are going to look at that and they're going to say, is this a US move in response to increased Chinese activity in the region? So, I mean, is that part of what's happening here?
I think the way to understand that program is to understand that it's part of our ongoing commitment to Pacific security. And that's a commitment that stretches all the way back to World War II. So over the decades, we've worked to build and train and help equip Pacific Island country security forces. And we've worked with them on joint maritime security initiatives. And also, especially when there were natural disasters, work to provide humanitarian assistance. So the security cooperation part isn't new. But we are, of course, also aware that China's increasing its activities in the Pacific Islands. And we're concerned about the implications for the long-term security and stability of the region. As China's involvement in the Indo-Pacific and in the Pacific Islands has grown, we've seen some really problematic behavior. Things like predatory economic activities and other things that might undermine good governance and promote corruption. And then we've seen what's happened in the South China Sea, and we continue to express our concerns there. So it is something that we're watching closely.
Do you think, though, to some extent that the U.S. sends out mixed messages on the China issue? Because, of course, the U.S. does have diplomatic relations with China, and yet there seems to be that concern that you've expressed there about what they may be up to in the Pacific.
I think the China issue is a really complex one. China's a huge country. We have very strong economic links there. We always seek to cooperate with China. We look for ways that we can work together, and we hope that China will play by the rules and play fair and cooperate with us in the international space. But when it doesn't, we don't hesitate to call them out.
And do you see a bit of a jockeying for position, if I can put it that way, in the Pacific at the moment? Because you're talking to me now about the US and their Pacific Pledge. Here in Australia, we have the Pacific Step Up. New Zealand have a similar policy. The European Union have a similar policy. It seems that people are queuing up to get into the Pacific all of a sudden.
I think you're onto something. What I would say is the U.S. has been a committed partner of the Pacific since World War II. We lost 60,000 American lives fighting in World War II, and we've been in the Pacific ever since. We've had Peace Corps there. There have been American missionaries there. There are business links. So it's not that we're just entering the Pacific now. But it is true we are turning up the volume on our engagement in the Pacific.
And what about the question of climate change? Because based on the opinion and the policy of the president, you have a bit of a difficult thing to judge here, don't you? Because clearly climate change is seen very, very differently in the Pacific. They are very concerned about what they say is a crisis.
Yeah, that's right. We've had lots of conversations with Pacific leaders about their concerns on climate change. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. is increasing its efforts to work on natural disaster resilience and weather forecasting. One of the other areas that we're working on globally is on helping countries use clean energy systems. The U.S. is really a leader in terms of growing our economy while reducing our greenhouse gas emissions.
And what about the U.S. ambassadorial presence in the Pacific? For example, currently you have an ambassador who serves Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands, but based in Port Moresby, the PNG capital. Do you have plans to open separate embassies in those other two countries, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands, and indeed elsewhere in the Pacific?
Like any other government, we're always reviewing our personnel in the Pacific. Right now, we are looking at expanding our personnel across the region. The State Department specifically is adding diplomats in Fiji and the Freely Associated States. USAID is expanding its presence in Fiji, Papua New Guinea, and several of the Freely Associated States as well. And the Defense Department is opening new defense attaché offices in Papua New Guinea and the Federated States of Micronesia.
Talking of FSM, the Federated States of Micronesia, also Palau is another example of countries that you have a compact of free association with. The nature of those individual compacts seems to be changing somewhat, perhaps a greater U.S. involvement than there has been in the past.
You know, I don't know that I would say that the nature of our involvement is changing. The compacts are legal documents. I think, like we're seeing across the Pacific, we're taking our strong baseline of ongoing U.S. presence in the Pacific and making it even stronger.
But Palau, for example, has become perhaps more important in the last couple of years. There was concern, of course, a year or so ago about what North Korea was up to, and there was a worry that, for example, Guam might have been targeted, and Palau became important essentially as a military base, and a missile tracking station will be opened there soon. So in that sense, these countries have taken on greater importance, haven't they?
We routinely partner with countries worldwide in pursuing our security objectives. Certainly North Korea is a particular concern for us, and we have worked with Pacific Island countries on different measures to help ensure that we're managing the North Korea situation appropriately.
And what about the relationship between the US and Australia in the Pacific? The Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison met President Trump quite recently. The timing of what's happened since seemed to have a lot to do with that meeting. I mean, are Australia and America essentially working together to some extent on Pacific policy?
The U.S. collaborates very closely with Australia and with New Zealand and Japan and other partners. This is something that's been in the works for a long time. Lining up $100 million in new U.S. government funding is not something we could have done in just a few weeks, but certainly it is something that we've had ongoing discussions with Australia and other partners about.
Jennifer Spandy, the U.S. State Department's Deputy Director for the Office of Australia, New Zealand and Pacific Affairs. So how does the American spin on their Pacific pledge stand up to scrutiny? Well, in the wake of the step up in Australia and New Zealand's reset, the United States have been late to the Pacific Party in the eyes of many, and their claim that they've been present in the region since the 1940s doesn't necessarily ring true. Dr. Siobhan McDonald is a legal anthropologist from the Australian National University who's working closely with the government of Vanuatu as they seek to take big emitters like the United States to court over climate change.
I think this is what they're trying to pull on, right, is this historical set of connections. You know, we are not only recently discovering the region, discovering in inverted commas, we've been here for a longer period of time. We have these long set of relationships. Pacific Island countries are not silly, though. They can see the effect of countries that have pulled out and are now choosing very late in the piece to re-engage.
Pacific analyst Dr. Tess Newton-Cain from Griffith University in Brisbane says the US would do better to abandon the World War II mantra and look to more recent impacts in the region, notably that funded by the Millennium Challenge Corporation.
You know, I was in Vanuatu last week, and even still people say to me, one of the most significant bits of development we ever got was the roads that were built by the Americans under the MCC. Now, that happened way after World War II, but that doesn't seem to get a mention in the rhetoric or in the diplomatic language about we've been here all the time.
And more generally, the tone of the American message and the way they're delivering it in the Pacific continues to raise eyebrows.
Sometimes the conversation can have quite a patronizing tone when it's directed towards Pacific leaders. And I think that's true of a lot of the hyperbole around Chinese debt traps. The idea that Pacific leaders are not making strategic decisions in this space is something that's often missed.
I have raised with American interlocutors that I've connected with this year. One of the things I've said to them is this isn't 1942 anymore. And one of the key things that needs to be remembered is that unlike in 1942, the countries that the US is now seeking these relationships with are sovereign independent states.
Under a president like Donald Trump, who doesn't believe in the science, it's perhaps surprising that the Pacific Pledge pays any attention to climate change at all. But Dr. McDonald says both Washington and Canberra have adopted somewhat schizophrenic strategies.
At a top level, at a prime ministerial level, they're not prepared to accept some of the language attached to the emergency of climate change in the region. But on the other hand, they are prepared to put funding into disaster, extreme weather event funding, resilience facilities. The reality, however, is that Pacific Island nations are increasingly saying to the US and to Australia in particular, you need to step up into this space. You need to acknowledge the Boyd Declaration that climate change is the single greatest security threat to the region. And we're expecting you to come with action.
So what is driving the US Pacific Pledge? Well, China for sure, but what about Australia's role? Tess Newton-Cain says the Washington-Canberra relationship as far as the Pacific is concerned is complex and evolving, particularly as America doesn't have enough boots on the ground.
They see Australia and to a lesser extent New Zealand as primary sources of information about the Pacific and primary locations of understanding about the Pacific. And again, I've heard Pacific people say to American thinkers in this space, come and talk to us directly, don't come via Canberra or Wellington. We would prefer a direct conversation. We don't want to have it filtered through other people.
And on the question of security and the US push to embed advisors in Fiji, Solomon Islands and Palau, Siobhan McDonald says it's getting mighty crowded.
Well, I mean, everybody is interested in being in this security space at the moment and getting as close to influence as is possible. So presumably an embedded security advisor is part of that strategy. Again, Pacific Island countries are not naive. They know if a security advisor is embedded, the interests of those security advisors are going to be divided, to say the least.
And furthermore, while the West may be suspicious of China, the Pacific Island nations rather like the Chinese way of doing business.
They appreciate the way the Chinese government is prepared to fund various infrastructure projects with less red tape, with less complications attached to them, for things that are a priority to the leadership of those countries. I think in that light, so the US introduction of $350 million with an additional $100 million spend is not a very significant amount of funding.
And Dr. Newton-Cain says Pacific leaders can see through what some would characterise as the smokescreen of US ambition on good governance and media freedom in the region.
I've heard it particularly in Solomon Islands, but also in Vanuatu and in Fiji. They see this rush to be back in the Pacific, or this insistence that we never left, is very much seen as a reaction to activities by other partners, particularly China. And what Pacific Island leaders are looking for are relationships based on their own value in their own right. They're not interested in being pawns in someone else's geostrategic chess game.
Dr. Tess Newton-Cain from Griffith University in Brisbane. You also heard from Dr. Siobhan McDonald at ANU in Canberra. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. There's concern in Vanuatu about a Chinese-owned development that's promising to transform the country into a magnet for tourists. Work has begun at an 86-hectare site on the main island of Efate to build Rainbow City, a gated community that will include schools and even a hospital when it's completed. But as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, some of those working on the project claim they've been underpaid, while more broadly, it's feared that local people will be locked out of this new high-end development.
Vanuatu is known for its untouched stretches of sand, empty shorelines and pristine waters. But a new development on the outskirts of the capital Port Vila could soon change all that. It's called Rainbow City and is the brainchild of Chinese businesswoman Rumin Cheng, who also goes by the name of Amy Feng.
I think it's very nice for tourists of the future. And then, of course, Vanuatu is like a very poor country.
Rainbow City is still being built, but when completed, the gated town will house villas, hotels, schools, shopping centres, and even a hospital. It's aiming to attract foreign investors from China, UK and Australia, but not a single property has yet been put on the market, let alone sold. But owner Ms. Cheng says local communities stand to benefit from the added jobs and tourism.
Helped Vanuatu to just like open the tourist market. The people come in a lot, make a tourists come here, you know.
Ms. Cheng says she has funded the early stages of the project through her private companies based in Vanuatu and in China. But some locals say they're already missing out on Rainbow City's riches. John Pokoa says he earned less than $2 an hour working as a casual labourer on the site, a claim that owner Rumin Cheng denies.
The Chinese bring in a lot of money, but they trick us to work. They push you really hard and then you only get a bit of money in return.
There's no shortage of foreign investment in Vanuatu's tourism sector, with entrepreneurs from around the world clamoring to carve out a space in this tropical paradise. But the development of this mini-town comes amid growing concern over Chinese influence in the region. Chinese-backed construction is booming in Vanuatu, funded not only by private citizens, but the state as well. The Chinese government paid for a multi-million dollar convention center in the city, along with the Prime Minister's new offices. Last year, both Washington and Canberra were alarmed at rumours that China would establish a permanent military presence in Vanuatu, despite both countries denying such talks ever took place. Gabrielle Towara, whose village borders Rainbow City, says she's worried about what these changes might mean for her and her family.
We worry how the Chinese come and build house and buy every place in Vanuatu, and we didn't understand why it buy Vanuatu.
She's also worried that Chinese workers will either refuse to buy fruit and vegetables from them or sell cheaper produce at markets.
They want to sell food, but they plant and haven't got anything to do it. We just stay home.
Gabrielle's son, Graham Towara, says he's also confused about why this latest development is screened from the public.
We was confusing about the Rainbow City. The community that we live around here. Actually, we was thinking that should be down, the mini town, but to build the wall around, and we don't know that should be what.
He could be waiting a long time to get an answer. Construction isn't due to be completed until 2030.
That's Priyanka Srinivasan with that report. Now, as an example of a country punching above its weight, Marshall Islands' achievement in winning a seat on the UN Human Rights Council takes some beating. They fought off a challenge from Iraq in the Asia Pacific to secure a 3-year stint alongside 46 other nations, including Australia and Fiji. But the Human Rights Council has often been characterised as nothing more than a toothless tiger. So, on the question of climate change in particular, what does a tiny nation in the North Pacific stand to gain from being part of it? Lauren Beldy put that question to John Silk, the Marshall's Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade.
It's important as a moral issue we brought to the forefront. We are a very small nation that we only came into existence 40 years ago, 1979. And for the first 20 years of our existence or so, we have been trying to build a nation. Now, in these last few years, we're trying to save a nation from disappearing. The science, a lot of people don't believe in the science. But science alone will not convince people. It's the moral obligation of the world and the immorality of basically letting some parts of the population, you know, world as distant as the Marshall Islands, perish because we don't live up to our commitments under the Paris Agreement and other international agreements.
You were saying earlier that the place on the Human Rights Council allows you to bring more human stories to the issue of climate change. I'm wondering whether it's the same when it comes to the impact of nuclear testing, which is something the Marshall Islands has also been very vocal about on the world stage.
That's true. And in fact, we want to share our experience with the nuclear testing as well in the council because, you know, we have experienced what it means to migrate or what it means to lose your island. We have that. And it's an experience we want to share with the rest of the world. We have our own population that have dispersed, been banned from going back to their home islands, and have now lived in other parts of the Marshall Islands, but you don't really feel like you're culturally connected because you're not from your home island. Our culture is all on land. We're 99% water and 1% land. The scarcity of land, and you identify yourself and your culture with your land. So we have experience of displaced of our own population and the migration of our own population to the rest of the Marshall Islands and throughout the United States and other parts of the world. Some of us are now living in Guam, some in Saipan and other places, but mostly in mainland United States and Hawaii. And so what we would like to bring to this council is the fact that we are already experienced displacement and migration. And this is an issue that needs to be addressed. How do we address migration and displacement of people? What kind of definition do you give to countries and people that have lost their country?
Now, you're one of 47 states that sit on the council at any one time. Now, that's a large portion of the number of nations in the world. And it includes nuclear countries and it includes some of the biggest polluters in the world. Do you see that as a problem?
That's true. It will always be a problem because we're not counting votes in the council. It's got to be by consensus. And I don't think we'll ever get a consensus from these big countries, big polluters. But at the same time, I think perhaps by continuously repeating our story for the next 3 years while we're on the council, maybe that would begin to turn a corner, especially in the hearts of these countries. It can be difficult to convince nations to change if you only argue about the science. But perhaps you should bring a different dimension to the table to argue about the immorality of what's happening.
That's John Silk, Marshall Islands Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, speaking there to Lauren Beldy, and you're listening to Pacific Review. And finally for this week, in Samoa, it happens just once a year during a waning moon and large crowds gather on the beaches to witness the occasion. As Jordan Fennell reports, it's the spawning of the Palolo worm, a highly prized Pacific delicacy.
Nestled in the corals of the Pacific Ocean is Samoa's caviar.
It's beautiful. It's salty and very, you can taste the richness of the iron in it.
Kareti McGurty is a Samoan woman who grew up eating the delicacy.
It looks like a worm. It's a worm, actually. And the way I love to eat it is just fry it with a bit of butter, eat it with a spoon or put it on top of the toast for breakfast if you're having it for breakfast.
It's called the Palolo worm, and once a year, huge crowds of Samoans gather on the beach in the middle of the night waiting for it to spawn. And once it does, it's gloves off and nets out as the race to collect as many as possible begins.
See, the Palolo. All these worms. Oh, yeah. Look at them.
The Palolo season is considered an especially significant time for Samoan families. Liz Ahi is a Samoan journalist and says the traditions surrounding it are special.
One of the things I love about the tradition of Palolo hunting is the rituals that go along with this event, which kind of lend to the mystery and mysticism surrounding it. I describe it as almost like a courting ritual, and it's traditional to dress up for the Palolo so as to attract more Palolo and have a favourable harvest. Traditionally, you'd see people wear their Sunday best to wade in the waters, and it's especially important to smell fragrant, which is why you'll see a lot of people wearing leis of ylang-ylang, called mosa'oi in Samoa. Living in a Christian island nation, it's nice to see these old practices haven't died out because there is so much beauty in those old traditions.
The Palolo season has traditionally been seen as a time of giving, when families would come together to gather and cook the worms and give it as a gift to friends and neighbours. Recently, though, it's become a highly prized commodity, with some fishermen selling it at the markets for up to 50,000 thaler, or just over $27,000 Australian dollars. This has caused some upset among the locals. And Coretti says that while her family would never sell the worms, she can understand why some people do.
There's some families that collect them, but they don't have much behind just having the palolo to eat. So to make some money for their living, day-to-day living, I suppose they'll have to sell that to get some good money for the family. So I can see the point of people that don't like the families that are selling them, but I can see the family's point of view as well.
And she says regardless of how people feel about it being sold, Samoans remain hooked on palolo.
Yeah, the whole island, everybody in the island are looking forward to that time to go and collect it because it rises once a year.
And that was Coretti McGirty speaking to our reporter Jordan Fennell about the palolo worm. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt, and thank you very much for listening.